नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय Sitata patra vyajanara paskrita Prasuna vaisair abhivarshata pati Pishanga vasa vanamalaya babhau Gano yathar kodupachapa vaidyutai
By the lightning. As the Lord passed along the public road of Dwarka, his head was protected from the sunshine by a white umbrella. White feathered fans moved in semicircles, and showers of flowers fell upon the road. His yellow garments and garlands of flowers made it appear as if a dark cloud were surrounded simultaneously by sun, moon, lightning, and rainbows. Purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami. The sun, moon, rainbow, and lightning do not appear in the sky simultaneously. When there is sun, the moonlight becomes insignificant. And if there are clouds and a rainbow, there is no manifestation of lightning. The Lord's bodily hue is just like a new monsoon cloud. He is compared herein to the cloud. The white umbrella over his head is compared to the sun. The movement of the bunch of hair fan of flukes is compared to the moon. The showers of flowers are compared to the stars. His yellow garments are compared to the rainbow. So all these activities of the firmament, being impossible simultaneous factors, cannot be adjusted by comparison. The adjustment is possible only when we think of the inconceivable potency of the Lord. The Lord is all-powerful, and in His presence, anything is impossible, can be made possible by His inconceivable energy. But the situation created at the time of passing on the roads of Dwarka was beautiful and could not be compared to anything besides the description of natural phenomena. We are reading today from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 11, entitled Lord Krishna's Entrance into Dwarka, text number 27. We welcome you to Sri Radha Gopinath Temple. In today's verse, Krishna is being showered with flowers. and the road is scattered with limitless flower petals for him to walk upon. And beautiful analogies are being made, comparing the beauty of the scene of God's incarnation on this earth, Krishna, in his own divine kingdom manifesting on earth in the form of Dwarka, and the loving exchanges between the Lord and all the living beings of Dwarka. Because this is transcendental beauty, there's really no comparison within the entire creation that can compare. Because the beauty of Krishna and the beauty of the love between Krishna and his devotees and all of the expressions and manifestations of those loves are without limit and without any influence of time. Whereas anything in this world to compare, it's all subject to deterioration and death, and it all has its limitations. But still, the great sages, Shukadev Goswami, Suta Goswami, they are trying to make as accurate a comparison as possible for us. And what is interesting is all these comparisons throughout the poetry and the hymns and the scriptures are always comparisons to nature in its pure state. We don't see such beautiful analogies or symbolic explanations of these divine pastimes to factories, to the roads of modern cities, even to scientific laboratories. The comparisons are always to flowers and the sun and the moon and the stars and the sky. Because the natural beauty of God's creation in its pure, unexploited way is it actually gives us a connection and a sense of the divine source within it. Aham sarvasya prabhavau matta sarvam pravartate. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna tells that he is the source of all material and spiritual worlds. Everything and everyone emanates from him. And Krishna also tells, for one who sees me everywhere and everything in me, for that person I'm never lost, nor are they ever lost to me. This is a very philosophical principle, because we are, as eternal souls, we are temporarily residing within these bodies. And the Bhagavad Gita explains the nature of these bodies is they are made of the gross material elements, which are predominated by the categories of earth, water, fire, air, and ether. And the mind is composed of the subtle elements. The mind, and subtler than the mind is the intelligence, and subtler than even than the intelligence is the subtlemost of all material elements within creation. and that is the ego, ahankar. It is that ahankar, that ego, that is the juncture between spiritual consciousness and material consciousness. When the ego is pure, it's like a mirror. It reflects the true glory of the soul. In that state, there's no greed, there's no envy, there's no suffering, there's no arrogance, there's no selfish passions. We see our own eternal nature. And in that state, we become fearless. Or let us say, we realize our fearlessness. In this material world, everyone on various levels and various ways at different times is affected by fear. Fear of death, fear of loss of a loved one, either by death or betrayal or disease or danger. Fear of economic disparity, fear of other living beings. Sometimes we're walking through the forest and there's just a simple little rope in the ground and we think it's a snake with a triangular head. So are you afraid? Probably you are, especially if you know people who have died of snake bites. So actually, what is the fear? The fear is something inherent within ourself. And we just see something or taste something or experience something that has a particular reminder of something within us, and fear may come. But when we understand we're the indestructible soul, and we understand the indestructible soul in others, then we become materially fearless. But due to the ego, we identify with this vulnerable situation, and we try to find our happiness in completely vulnerable experiences. But here we find that the eternal soul and its relationship with the super soul, or Krishna, is perfect and pure. And material creation is what we have to work with, because we are conditioned souls. We may not be in our perfect, liberated, enlightened state. We are vulnerable to lust and envy and anger and greed and illusion and fear. And to try to pretend that we're not doesn't really solve our problems for any sustainable duration. We cannot just suppress our material conditionings. Yoga or spiritual life is to transcend it, not to suppress it. Alone. So this material creation, we can actually experience God in creation if we're not in the consciousness of exploiting the creation. This is a very subtle but sacred principle. Because in Bhagavad Gita it is said, ye yatamam prapadyante tamstathaiva bhajamyam. That according to our state of consciousness, according to our spirit of surrender or devotion, the Lord reciprocates and reveals himself. Not only directly, but through everything and through everyone. Because ultimately, every living thing is a part and parcel of the Supreme Lord. And everything in creation is the
artistic gift of the Supreme Lord. It is all his energy. Om Purnam Adha Purnam Idam. The Isha Upanishad explains that everything is emanating from the Absolute. The Absolute is perfect. Therefore, everything in its perfect, in its true state, is divine. Everything is spiritual. What is the difference between spiritual and material? It's not that you can't see spiritual, but you can see material. Spiritual and material recognition is state of consciousness. Just like our guru Srila Prabhupada would say, that is this microphone spiritual or material? It depends on our perception. If we use the microphone and perceive the microphone as a way to try to gain material things, then it is material. But if we see it as the sacred property of Krishna and use it for the service and the pleasure of Krishna and for the upliftment of others, then this microphone is pure spiritual energy. It always was pure spiritual energy. Everything in creation forever is pure spiritual energy if we perceive its connection. And in this sense, the Bhagavad Gita teaches what is yoga. To actually see the unity of everything and everyone in harmony with its actual true nature. So the creation, when we hear these beautiful poetic descriptions of the stars and the sky and the sun and the moon and the rivers and the oceans and the mountains and the trees and the plants, and especially today, the flowers. According to our perception, we will have a different experience. If we see the flower as someone who has hay fever, and we know we're going to start sneezing uncontrollably any minute in this company of all these distinguished people, then we're going to feel a certain experience in the flowers, especially once we start sneezing and our eyes start burning. If we're an artist, we may look at the flower and see all the different textures and colors and think, how can I paint it just like this? How wonderful, how beautiful. No human being with all masterpiece artistic qualities can ever paint a single flower petal with all of the grandeur of that flower petal. Its texture, its fragrance, its sight. If we're in love with a man or a woman, we see the flower, we're thinking, if only I could decorate his or her hair with this flower. And if we have some love of God, we see the flower as God, as Krishna's beautiful creation. And when we have a grateful heart, we want to use gifts in such a way that we can express our gratitude to who we have given the gifts to. One famous writer, I believe his name is William Blake, he wrote that gratitude is heaven itself. When we actually have a grateful heart, we can be in heaven anywhere, in any situation. If we don't have a grateful heart, there's no real meaningful or fulfilling happiness in any situation. And what does it mean to be grateful? When gratitude is on a spiritual platform, it's not just for the things we want. It's for whatever is. We may not like situations. We may even have to fight against situations. But we're grateful for certain opportunities that are there for us. In Bhagavad Gita, even though Arjuna and his brothers were exploited, were plundered, and the ruling king was exploiting the innocent people of the world for his own purposes, and there had to be a fight, Arjuna didn't like the situation, but he was grateful that he had the opportunity, even in this difficult situation, to do something good. Recently, our Bhaktivedanta hospital, just last year, they went to Nepal just after this earthquake. And so many people were dead, and so many people injured. Their homes were destroyed. Their little shops where they did business were destroyed. And nobody has insurance policies. When it's gone, it's gone. There's no way to recover it materially. What to speak of their fathers or mothers or brothers or sisters or children who were killed or injured, and they themselves with broken limbs. So Bhaktivedanta Hospital went there to help. And interestingly, there was a large demand for orthopedic surgeons because a lot of broken limbs. But more than the broken limbs are broken hearts. You know, you can fix somebody's arm and put it in a cast. And that gives some relief. But if their loved ones are dead, and they're hopeless without any way to even get food because they're homeless. You know, putting a cast on their arm is not going to help them so much, even if it's an upper cast. It's not gonna. They need that, but they need more. So along with that, the spiritual care, we're giving people transcendental knowledge as a way to actually perceive the value, the significance that their life still has, and the difference that they could make even in this very dire situation. And it was the spiritual care and the talks on Bhagavad Gita and the kirtans especially that really were healing people. They were learning that whoever has died, we may miss them physically. We may miss the medium of the body that's between our soul and their soul. But we know that their souls are forever, and we can still pray for them, and we can still offer puja on their behalf and impel blessings to still come upon that soul. And we can feel them within our heart when we actually feel God's presence within our heart. So these people, that's what they were really most desperate for, is to restore that higher principle of the real meaning and purpose of their life beyond the uncertainties of this world. And after some time, these very people who lost relatives and lost home, they were being facilitated to cook prasad, spiritual food, and to give it to others. And they know what starvation was like because they were just starving. Sounds like he might be starving. Of course, I'm talking too much, so you might be like that too. But they experienced what it's like to have lost everything. And they were actually with a spiritual perspective. What can I do to help others? And when you help others, you actually become liberated. When we concern ourselves on a spiritual level with other people's problems, then we don't really have any problems ourselves, because problems are based on perception. And they were taking the doctors house to house to heal people who had the same kinds of broken limbs that they had. And they were actually blissful. They weren't blissful to see the suffering. They were sad to see the suffering. But because they had a sense of compassion and a sense that they could do something about it, they were blissful to do something about it. And this is an apparent contradiction that's within material existence. How could anybody be happy when there's so much tragedy and death and exploitation in so many places of the world? We're sad about that. But we actually connect with the happiness of the soul when we do something about it. And some of these people from Nepal, after all the stuff that they've gone through, it was, I believe, the monsoon rainy season, and way up there in the Himalayas, it really gets cold. And they're just living in little tents that are just being borrowed from somebody. And it was so difficult, but they were really, really so grateful. Gratitude is heaven itself. They were feeling to be in heaven, even in this difficult situation, because they had the chance to serve. They had the chance to really make a difference for the body, mind, and especially the soul. So they wanted to come to Mumbai, about 30 of them, and I was supposed to meet them here. And they came. And it was after all they went through in Kathmandu, in the valley, they were explaining to me when I met them here. That because of the disaster, there was so much disorganization, there became violent conflicts between people of different religions. And because of that, and it's, you know, politically motivated, it's not spiritually grounded. It's spirit, religion is just used as like the weapon to get somebody, but the actual purpose is the darkness that's still there in people's hearts. So they had a railway ticket, and it was really hard for them to get these railway tickets, and it was from India. They had to take a bus. So the government closed all the roads and stopped all the buses. It was serious. So they had no way to get their train. They already paid for their train and was coming from Gorakhpur in India. So somehow or other, at midnight, they bribed a truck driver to smuggle them out. 30 of them in the back of this old Indian, not even Indian, Nepalese truck. And it was raining on them and it was cold on them, and they had to go through the mountains and through the valleys of the Himalayas, and they finally came down to India. All night long driving, all day the next day. And when they got to Gorakhpur, they found out that their train was canceled. And they may have to wait a week to get another seat. And they hadn't eaten anything. They didn't have any food. And somehow or other, they convinced another truck to drive them to Varanasi. And when they got to Varanasi, they somehow or other got on a train, and it was a really crowded train. And it took them to another place and another place, and finally they came to Mumbai, and they hadn't eaten any food in days. What to speak of bathing? It was really rugged. But I have to say, they looked hundreds of times blissful, more blissful than most of you today. They really looked blissful. It was incredible. And I said, why are you? And they were just saying, we can't be any happier than this. And I said, well, after everything you just told me you went through, why are you so happy? And they said, because we're so grateful to be here. And they said, we didn't even really suffer on the way because we were so grateful that we were coming here. One of my dear godbrothers, Sridhar Maharaj, he was a very wonderful personality. He was from Canada, but he lived in India for about 40 years. And he was dying of a disease, a terminal disease. And he was in a holy place of Mayapur, and I went to his bedside when he was just in his last days. And he looked at me and he smiled. And he said something I'll never forget. He said, pain is inevitable, but suffering is optional. And he was really blissful. He said, in this world, you know, emotional pain and physical pain, there's three kinds of miseries. The scriptures tell us miseries caused by our own body and mind, miseries caused by other living beings, mosquitoes, sometimes barking dogs, and especially from other humans for various reasons. And emotionally, we're usually most vulnerable to suffer from the people we love. If somebody that we don't really care about says something, it hurts a little. But if someone we really put our trust and love in, if they betray us, it's really painful. You know, most of the songs that they sing and are sad songs about being some kind of inconsistency in loving relationships. Yes, that's Western music, and more and more Indian music too. And most of these love songs, or these songs of sorrow, they're not about what a stranger does to you. It's always someone who've given your heart to. It hurts. So these things happen in this world. Miseries caused by other living beings and miseries caused by natural disturbances. Too much heat, too much cold, earthquakes. Some of you have just come from New York City and Washington, D.C., where there was a lot of snow. I'll never forget, years ago I took a group of people from Mumbai to Badrinath, which is a very holy place way up in the Himalayas. And we were in Rishikesh, which is on the way. From Rishikesh you have to drive in a bus. And it was interesting because when we went to board the bus, we saw every window had streaks under the window on the side of the bus. And I was wondering, what are all these streaks? It's a strange way to paint a bus. And then I looked closer and I saw what it really was. It was, well, I don't want to go into graphic details. But the winding roads going up to the Himalayas with high altitude, everyone got really nauseous and expressed their condition out the window and on the side of the bus. So that was not exactly what the tourist agency promised people. But if we were pilgrims, and all the way, people in Mumbai were asking me, will we get to see snow? Because they had never seen snow in their life. Because in the last so many centuries, it has never snowed in Mumbai. And people born and raised here, you know, they hear about snow and the Himalayas. Himalaya means the abode of snow. So they were really excited about seeing snow. They were asking, will we see snow? And I was born and raised in north of Chicago. So I'm not so excited about snow. I said, maybe. Maybe we'll see snow. And we got there, and it was on Narasingha Chaturdasi, a very holy day we arrived. And it was, in Rishikesh, it was about 110 degrees. And when we got to Badrinath, there was no snow anywhere. It was actually hot up there. And people were kind of really disappointed. It seemed like some people, that was really a package part of the pilgrimage, is just not only to see God, but to see snow. So we started chanting, and I never saw anything like this. A few minutes after we were chanting, these gigantic clouds, dark clouds formed in the sky. And it snowed, and snowed, and snowed, and kept snowing, and snowed more. And within a half hour, it was like really deep snow, and it was freezing cold and high winds. And then we were told that before going in the temple, you're supposed to bathe in the river. It's the Alaknanda River, and it's just a few miles north. It's just coming out of a glacier. So it's ice cold. The only reason it's not solid is because it's moving so fast. And we go to take our bath, and it's really cold, and it's freezing, and the winds are blowing. And the snow is pouring, and still we're supposed to bathe. And you're supposed to go in the temple after that. And I remember I just had two sets of clothes, and I put them down, and I went into the river. It was really cold. And I decided to do Gayatri Mantra, which takes about usually 5 minutes. But I think I said it in about 1.5 minutes. It was too cold, because I was doing it up to my neck in the river. And I came out, and I went to get my clothes, and some really generous, well-wishing person wanted to assist me. So he grabbed my clothes to bring it to me, and he slipped in the snow, and my clothes fell in the river. And I grabbed them, and I put them on. It was like, within seconds, they were solid ice. So that was experience. And because it snowed so much, the roads, because it's way up on the mountains, the roads were blocked. There was an avalanche of snow. So no one could come in and no one can go out from this mountaintop holy place. So we couldn't leave. And there's no place there with heat in those days. This was in the 80s. So we're all just sitting around freezing with no relief, and nobody brought warm clothes. And I turned to everyone and said, "Are you happy to see the snow?" And they said, "No, we're not." I said, "No, you should be grateful." And actually, we all became very happy, because it was so cold and we were so helpless, and one person was suffering a heart attack. He was an older man, and there was no doctors or anything. And one of our devotees, who has a PhD in engineering, because he has a PhD, they call him Dr. Desai. He came and said, "My name is Dr. Desai." And this older man was dying of heart attacks. He said, "Please help me." He said, "There's no hospital, there's no medical equipment." I said, "As your doctor, I advise you, the only medicine you have now is God's names." And he said, "And I will give you the medicine. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare." And he really took the medicine seriously, because he didn't have anything else. And he lived. And a couple days later, the roads were cleared, and he was so grateful. He was so grateful. It was the deepest spiritual experience he ever had in his life. So these people from Nepal, when they came to me, they were just so happy, because they were grateful that they could come, and they were grateful that they were here, and that they were so grateful that they had the opportunity of doing such significant service that had such an impact on people's lives. So that sadness and that sadness of seeing other people in such situations, whether they're human or animals or whatever, it's a way of expressing compassion. And to the degree we're actually connected to Krishna's grace, to God's grace within our hearts, we could be such powerful instruments of compassion. But how to see like that? To the degree we have a mood of service, we could see from that perspective. From a degree we have a selfish, exploitative purpose, we can't see the gifts that are all around us. We're always craving for something else. And the example given here is these beautiful analogies of nature. When nature is being exploited and polluted, we can't really perceive its true beauty. But why? Have you seen the river Ganges way up in the Himalayas where it's crystal clear and aqua blue and just the most radiant, incredible feast for the eyes and the heart to see a pure river? And then you go about 500 miles down and you see tons of sewage being dumped into it, an industrial waste and all kinds of foaming bubbles due to pollution. You don't see the same thing. It's the same Ganges. So similarly, when we don't have this pollution within our own hearts, we can actually see the world for what it truly is, in its original natural state, because we can see its connection with Krishna. And we can feel the gratitude in every situation in which we can make a difference. So in this beautiful story, a few chapters back, we learn Krishna was residing in Dwarka at that time. When he was young, he lived in Vrindavan, and then to Mathura and Dwarka. And there was tremendous exploitation by Duryodhana, who was a very evil prince, who through manipulation and very, very cruel politics and arrogance, he usurped the entire kingdom from very pious, loving, compassionate people headed by Yudhisthira and Arjuna and Bhima. And Krishna, who is God himself, took the role of a human being. Sometimes he engaged in activities which were absolutely, supremely supernatural and incredible and can never be imitated. But other times, he taught by his example of how to be a human being and live in such a way that we could actually really progress in our life. So he tried in so many different ways to convince the aggressive party to be fair. Because everyone has free will. Krishna is Abhigya and Swarat. The Lord has complete independence and knows everything. And mamaivam so jiva loke jiva bhuta sanat. And as a part of God, we can know some things. And we also have free will. And nothing and no one can ever take away our free will. The famous story of Socrates. He was in prison, in a dungeon. And they came to bring him poison to drink. And they told him to drink it. And Socrates smiled. said, before you could kill me, you have to find me. I don't know if the jail keeper understood that level of philosophy. But he wasn't really disturbed by it, because my soul is immortal, and you can't find my soul, so you cannot kill me. This temporary shell of a body, it's going to die sometime soon anyway. There's nothing you can do about that. So even in that situation, by his free will, he chose enlightenment rather than depression. So we always have free will, to serve or to exploit, to be humble or to be arrogant, to be generous or to be greedy, to be kind or to be cruel. That's the very heart of our life, is how we utilize our free will. And God himself will not interfere with someone's free will. But yada yada hi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharata. Again and again comes to this world in so many ways to establish so many spiritual paths and religious movements, just to teach us how to utilize our free will in such a way that we can grow, we can prosper. And that real growth and prosperity is an understanding the eternal wealth of the love of God that's within all of us, and to share that love in great abundance in whatever we do. So Krishna made every effort to try to settle things. But Duryodhana and his people became more and more exploitative and envious. And ultimately, there had to be Kurukshetra. The Mahabharata specifically speaks about this great battle that took place. The most negative situation is war. But even in that negative situation, Krishna spoke Bhagavad Gita there. So one of the greatest blessings to all of humanity, the Bhagavad Gita has given eternal enlightenment and ecstatic love to countless people for 5 millenniums. But it was spoken in the context of the most unfortunate situation of an impending war. And ultimately, the Pandavas were victorious. And Krishna came back to Hastinapur, and Yudhisthira was coronated as king. But Yudhisthira was such a gentle, humble person. He was thinking that all the suffering of everybody, it's my fault. Even though actually nothing was his fault, but he was thinking it was his fault. He was taking responsibility that just so that I could be a king, look at all these widows and look at all these orphans and look at all this difficulties. Even though he tried to do everything as fair as possible, it was forced on him. So Krishna took Yudhisthira back to the battlefield of Kurukshetra. And there the great grandfather Bhishma was laying down in his last moments. And even though his body was pierced with arrows, Bhishma, when he saw Krishna, he became completely happy. And a large part of Mahabharata is the wisdom, the knowledge, and the realization that he shares with the world in that condition. He's literally on his deathbed, and he's enlightening human society forever. There are so many chapters and chapters and chapters of his teachings on so many various subjects of Dharma. And then he just looks at Krishna, and in great love and happiness, he gives his heart, and he attains the ultimate supreme perfection. And now Yudhisthira is completely happy. And he comes back because he's been enlightened by his grandfather. And as Krishna's leaving Hastinapur, that kingdom, it's describing how everyone was so happy that he was there, but so sad that he was leaving. And there's an entire chapter of the loving reciprocation that Krishna had with all of these beautiful people as he was living Hastinapur. And today's chapter, he's just entering into Dwarka after a very long time of being away. In spiritual love, there is two principles, sambhog and vipralamba. Sambhog means the love of being in physical union, being together like we are now. And vipralamba is the love that we feel for each other in separation. And of the two, they both dynamically increase the other. When there's separation and the object of our love returns, then how much greater is the experience than if he never left or she never left? And this is especially in the soul's relationship with the Supreme Soul. So vipralamba makes the union even sweeter. And similarly, the union makes the vipralamba sweeter. Because when we meet and then we're separated, that separation is even deeper. So the people of Dwarka were for a long time, and they're explaining in this chapter, every moment seemed like thousands of years without Krishna. But in that state, they're actually with Krishna. In love of God, when God is in front of us, or if our loved one is in front of us, the love of our heart goes out from our heart to reciprocate with that person. Through seeing the person, through the words to that person, through gestures for that person. But in physical absence, that love, we don't have the medium to come out to reciprocate. So that love goes deeper and deeper and deeper within. And in material relationships, that could be kind of painful. But in spiritual relationships, God is within our heart. And when our love goes deep in our heart, Krishna reciprocates. He embraces us from within the heart in the most intimate and a special way. So here, Krishna is returning after a long time, and everybody is so happy. They make such a celebration to receive him. And the celebration is very simple. We read in today's verses, as he's walking by, they're showering flower petals upon him. And Krishna doesn't care about flower petals. He doesn't need our flower petals. But our love. And historically, on every level, flowers have always been spiritually, materially, a way of expressing love. Its origin is in here. We read in Vrindavan, the gopis, they are considered by the greatest of the renunciates and the greatest of the scholars to be the highest yogis, the gopis of Vrindavan. Balabhacharya, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Rupa Goswami, Sanatan Goswami, Raghunath Das Goswami, Ramanujacharya, Madhvacharya. They all exclaim the gopis to have the highest, fullest state of love. And mostly what they do is they make flower garlands and they collect flowers. And Srimati Radharani, who is the pleasure potency, the supreme reservoir and source of all love and creation, the Thladini Shakti, the ultimate potency of love, that's the source of everything that exists, that's Radha. In Ram's Leela Shisita, at Kusum Sarovar, where the most beautiful pastimes of Radha and Krishna take place, at Radhakund, Radharani collects flowers. She's plucking flowers and making garlands. Actually, anyone can do that. It's the love in which it's expressed. And even today in this world, usually if you love someone, you give them flowers. Or if someone is sick in the hospital, you send them flowers. Flowers have always been a medium to express affection. But it's not the flower. It's the purpose. If someone who hates you gives you flowers, does it make you happy? You wonder, why is he doing this? What did he put in the flowers? But if someone who loves you, whether it's a husband or a wife or a son or a daughter or whatever, a lover, beloved, it has great meaning. Because flowers are so simple, but it's a way of expressing love. Patram pushpam palam toyam. Here the great queens of Dwarka are showering flowers on Krishna. In Vrindavan, the gopis are picking flowers and making garlands for Krishna. Such simple things. In Ram's Leela, when Ram and Sita were in Chitrakoot, Sita would go out into the forest to collect flowers. And she would make garlands and bouquets. And then her and Ram would make garlands and they would give them to the great yogis and sages and rishis. Because these great enlightened beings loved Sitaram more than their whole lives. And Sitaram loved them more than they loved their own lives. So Sita and Ram are making flowers and garlands and offering them to their own devotees. So this is an eternal principle. And when Ravana wanted to steal Sita away, he came before her and said, I'm very hungry. And out of compassion, she got some nice fruits that she picked, simple fruits to present to him. Because of her compassion. Of course, he tried to exploit it. So today, I'm seeing PhD professors, and I'm seeing people who can't even write their names, I'm seeing people from Sweden and Australia and the United States of America, and people from Russia and Ukraine, and people from all different parts of India, from every possible caste in India, from every community in India. There's Bengalis and Maharashtrians and Gujaratis and Biharis and people from Tamil Nadu and Karnataka and Kerala. I see multimillionaires. I see monks who just sleep on the floor and don't have a single thing to their name. From an American perspective, I see Democrats and Republicans. I see members of Congress and BJP. Males and female. I see great-grandparents, great-grandchildren. Generations, so many generations, so many nationalities, so many religious backgrounds, so many races and species. Everyone is here together, plucking flowers. So uncomplicated, but so sweet. It creates such unity. Nobody's higher or lower. It's not that the multimillionaire who has 10,000 employees and stockholders, 60,000 stockholders in their companies and CEOs, it's not that they're any more significant here than a little child from a village. Everyone's just plucking flowers. The idea of true equality is on a spiritual level, of the ability to appreciate the capacity of our true oneness as parts of God, as true brothers and sisters in our love for God and love for each other. When you water the root of the tree, naturally that root goes to every, that water extends to every part of the tree. This festival is a festival of love. It's called a flower festival, Pushyabhishek. The origin of it is described in these beautiful verses of the scriptures. To appreciate, we all have the potential and the capacity to show our love. Whether we're champion bodybuilders or we're invalid old people, there's no qualification or disqualification. We could all pluck a flower, somehow or other. And if we do it with gratitude, and we do it with the will to love, then we're united on a spiritual level. It's one family. To recognize and appreciate our diversity, but at the same time, to recognize and appreciate the essence in which we all share together. And tonight, when we shower all these flowers that you have collected, it is a united offering of all of our hearts and every single little petal. In Krishna's eyes, is more valuable than treasure houses of gold and silver and diamonds and rubies, because each petal is picked by you with this state of consciousness as an offering of devotion. And when we can learn to find happiness in this appreciation for one another, in such divine seva, That is our greatest blessing. Thank you very much.